This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got three sponsors for the show. Firstly, Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite MDM solution for Macs and iOS devices. Aerohive, makers of cloud-managed controllerless Wi-Fi. And finally, iDev Books, a Finnish app design company who've been making iOS mathematics apps for 5 years now. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
Hello, how are we?
Not too bad, how are you?
It's a great day, great day. Mm-hmm. It's Thursday, so I am getting close to, we're getting close to fall break. So yeah. That means that 25% of the school year is over. Next is tomorrow, I guess tomorrow. Yeah, the first 9 weeks ends tomorrow. So we'll be doing report cards soon and all that fun stuff.
Yep, we are one day away from holidays. Tomorrow's Friday and that's the beginning of the holidays. So, well, the end of Friday is the beginning of the holidays, so looking forward to that.
Yes, yes, we are too. We've got a fun trip planned. We are going to Disney World for fall break.
Okay, very good.
So I've not been since I was five, so it'll be fun.
May have changed a little bit, I don't know.
Probably better Wi-Fi now than then.
Possibly, yeah. So we last show we recorded, we actually recorded it quite far ahead of when we put it out. We were a whole week ahead. And we missed a few things that happened in between the recording and the publication of that show. So I thought we'd maybe mention some of those before we went on.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the first one, obviously, I think is kind of big in our lives, is the announcement that Google Drive for Education or Google Apps for Education is going unlimited quotas for education, which I think is huge. I mean, obviously, unlimited is as big as you can get. But in terms of an advancement for that platform, I think it's a really big deal for us.
Well, and I think, you know, you remember too, you can sync files up to 5 terabytes. I mean, I could conceivably sync VMware and a VMware image over Google Drive. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you would ever want to do that, but you could do it.
Well, I do have a rather large file sitting on my desktop that I can't upload to Google Drive right now, so I'm looking forward to it's an archive of a computer that we decommissioned a while ago, and I thought I'd put it up to Google Drive for safety, but I can't quite get the upload done on any browser at the moment.
One of the things that this is really, you know, unlimited storage is great, and this will save us a little money because I've got a handful of users that did upgrade and are paying the $2 a month. And really, the annoyance of it isn't the $2 a month, but it's that you can only pay monthly. They don't even have an annual option, so we're turning in receipts every month for $199 that you're expensing out. And the downside, too, that Google doesn't even email you, or I can't figure out a way to make it email you when there's like a payment, a transaction. So I have to remember to go check like in the middle of the month. Like, I need to print off my Google Drive receipt. And I think looking back, you remember the business accounts have a way to buy basically an extra pool of storage and distribute that.
Yep.
I think now we understand why education didn't get that.
Yeah, well, we mentioned that a few shows ago, a couple months ago. I had looked into that for one of our staff members that was getting close to the 30 gig limit. And I called them up and they said, no, there's no way for you to provision storage for your users. Never, you know, you just have to do it the consumer way. And I think, you know, you're right that here's why, because they were going to take all those limits away, which is awesome.
Yeah, but for me at our organization, this is actually a huge cost savings on the archiving. Cause so we have paid typically like, I think $1,800 a year for, it was the Postini message archiving, and it's archived, you know, messages for 10 years that you could go back and pull in case of a lawsuit or just in case of an accidentally deleted message. That is now free for school as well. So I literally, ours comes up due in November, and so I literally don't have to pay for that anymore. I mean, that's for us, that's pretty big because, you know, as much as unlimited storage is nice, we are actually saving money because we were paying for this before.
Yeah, no, that's great. We haven't paid for that in the past, but we... It's something I've thought about, and I've looked at the cost and thought, not sure. But it will certainly be something that we will use and will be nice to have when it's free. So, yeah.
The question is, why are they doing this? And I think it's one of two reasons. Mm-hmm. A, it's to test the waters for doing unlimited in consumer world. Because obviously they're oversubscribing. They're not expecting everyone to immediately upload 5 terabyte files. This is just... They, you know, they know people's usage won't change dramatically, and so they can afford to do this. And so you wonder if they're testing this for the consumer world, but also, you know, are they doing this to kind of like as another get into the ecosystem, get into Google Drive, use Google Drive, buy Chromebooks, things like that.
Mm-hmm. No, I can definitely see both of those arguments, and it's probably a combination of both, to be honest, isn't it? I think, for us, one of the big things is that you just never have to think about it anymore. And our model of using this as an offline storage for iOS devices, I think, is going to play it really nicely. As long as, I think, realistically, we could use with a bump in upload bandwidth from our school or some kind of intermediate, you know, caching device or something like that would sort of more reliably stream uploads to Google Drive, because sometimes the uploading from the device can be a little bit slow or flaky, particularly when lots of people are doing it in one go.
So this will be interesting to see kind of how this evolves out. But yeah, exciting news.
I
hope we see some update. I'd love to see an update to the Mac and iOS clients to kind of mature out their features a little bit more. I'd love to see better selective syncing on the Mac. And Chris, I'd love to see an iPhone 6 update on iOS. And again, I think I'd love to see just more features on iOS. I want to see it as a document storage provider on iOS 8.
Yep.
And I would love to see the ability to do more, have it automatically upload my photos to Google Drive instead of having to use a third-party app to do it.
No, I agree with all of those sentiments. I think these apps have definitely gotten better in the past year, particularly the Sheets application, I think, is much better than it used to be. That's my kind of main... These are my main apps, I think, right now that I'm still waiting for an update for iPhone 6 is the Google suite of apps. Although Gmail has had one, but not the Drive apps yet.
So we can't have nice things.
We can't have them all at once, that's for sure.
So before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Aerohive Networks. They unleash the power of enterprise mobility. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their businesses. Supporting over 13,000 enterprises worldwide, Aerohive's mobility platform takes advantage of the cloud and a distributed architecture to deliver a unified, intelligent, and simplified network. So again, you can do a public or private cloud for your management system for your wireless network. But the cool thing about it is it's a distributed architecture. So this management system doesn't have any kind of interaction day to day with the network. Like if this management system goes down, your network still works fine, which is not the case for, like if you use, Meraki, if their server goes down, you actually lose a lot of functionality. Aerohive is a distributed architecture, so it's really fantastic. They got a great community portal called Hive Nation. It's at community.aerohive.com. If you want to learn more about them, visit aerohive.com. It's aerohive.com. So thanks to Aerohive for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay, cool. The other thing that happened during our intermission, if you like, was the Evernote conference, where there, as always, there are some, I think I described it as a WWDC of productivity, but it's always a good time and always quite interesting to see the people that they've got up and the kinds of things that they're announcing. And there's a couple of interesting updates to Evernote.
Yes, the web interface, the beta, looks very, very streamlined.
Yeah. Have you tried it much yet?
Yeah, I've used it once or twice. You know, I mainly live in the desktop app day to day, and then I'll use the iPad app quite a bit at home as well.
Yeah.
But like just seeing the web app and getting a feel for their future, I am very happy that my Evernote account is set to be premium until 2020. I've basically prepaid until 2020. So my oldest kid will be 10 when my account expires.
Well, just as well, like I say, just as well, Phil Lubin's building a 100-year company there. But yeah, I agree with you. I tried the new web client today for the first time, and it was really slick and nice. And I think, you know, the Evernote Mac app is very much a kind of dashboard and nerve center for everything you do with Evernote. But if I wanted to just sort of sit and write for a while, I think the web client there's a reasonable case for using the web client over the desktop client if you just want to sit and type out some stuff in Evernote. I certainly hope that the desktop client will get a design refresh that matches the nice defaults that are in the web client now as well.
Well, no, I think they said that's coming. I think they had a picture of it, so that is coming.
Yeah there's so, a Yosemite overhaul coming that.
And assuming, you know, Yosemite will probably be out before the end of the month, so maybe that'll be out in November sometime.
It's looking like it, isn't it? Yep.
So, yeah, no, Evernote's one of those products. The more I use it, the more I'm convinced that it's such an amazing tool. It's not perfect. It's not the... You know, it doesn't support Markdown. It's not the kind of the quote unquote favorite of a lot of the nerds out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I just continually throw stuff at it. And when I need something, I search for it. It works. I've got using Scanbot as my scanner on the iPhone and got it set to auto upload to my inbox folder on Evernote. It couldn't be easier. It's take a picture, add Grayscale, hit save, it uploads. I'm off and running. So yeah, it's one of those apps that I absolutely could see myself using for the next 10 years.
Yeah. I think the breakthrough for me with Evernote was when I started to look at it like Gmail. And again, Gmail is not perfect. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of things that Gmail gets right. There's some things that it gets okay, particularly the Compose experience is nothing like as good, I think, as Mail on OS X, because it's not as native and not as integrated. But if I look at my Evernote like a big archive notebook, the same way that Gmail is like a big archive of email, it's that kind of unlocked a lot of potential for me that I could actually rely on the Evernote search in the same way that I rely on the Gmail search. And I would pretty much get what I wanted back whenever I wanted it. And I've just been done a round of stuff with my accountants, and they were looking for various receipts and things. And I could just search them in Evernote, find them, and email them off to them straight away, which is it's a fundamental part of sort of productivity now for me, is to be paperless and to use Evernote for almost all of what we do there. Google Drive for some of the rest. But primarily, my personal stuff mainly lives in Evernote and OmniFocus.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. It's Google Drive, OmniFocus, and Evernote, and those are kind of my three systems, and they all work well together, and very, very happy with it.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like a whole show in itself. At some point, we should probably talk about our workflows. I think that would be an interesting thing for the listeners.
I hope. Yeah, absolutely.
I hope so. I don't know. Yeah. Send us feedback if you would like that show. Outofschool.net, there's a feedback form there. Let us know if you would like to hear that show. I did something interesting today as well, Bradley, just back to the sort of iPhone 6 and 6 Plus discussion. Part of my job is to drive the bus for the kids to go to PE, and they were doing gymnastics this week, and this was the last day they were doing that particular block of work. So I used my iPhone 6 to shoot some slow-mo video of the kids performing the moves that they had practiced over the term and stuff, and it worked, turned out really great. It was super cool. The 240 frames per second mode on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus is just crazy slow. And really enjoyed shooting those videos and cutting them together. I actually edited and put together the whole thing on my iPhone, which was reasonably easy. A wee bit more fiddly than doing it on the iPad, but still not too bad. And then it's posted on our school blog, so I will stick the URL for that in the show notes as well. But the thing that I thought was really interesting about it was that, I mean, I brought it home and I showed some of the teachers, and they just said, what an amazing teaching tool that is. You know, I thought of it as just a fun kind of technical thing to do, but they were said, look at what the kids could learn by looking at the performance there and seeing exactly how they, misaligned their legs or, you know, blew the landing somehow or whether they did well, you know, and you can see all these different things. So I thought that was something that's an interesting indicator for the future. And certainly in many schools I've been to and worked with, that one of the groups of teachers who are furthest out ahead on this kind of thing is actually the PE teachers, because they can record performances in sport and so on, and they can analyze it down to the frame. And I think that's a really powerful thing. And as the cameras get better, this becomes higher quality and easier to do as well.
Oh, I would have killed for this playing high school baseball. You had to bring your camcorder and you got terrible shots with it. And there was really no easy way to go back and watch them. You had to plug it up to your TV through the AV cables. And, you know, I can imagine if you had some sort of system where you could mount an iPad at a great angle for baseball or softball and have it beaming the video back to another iPad that the coach could watch and, you know, rewind and annotate. And then you imagine if you had like shared Google Drive folders, I mean, literally by the time the kids got home from practice, they could have video to watch. And that's all conceivable with today's technology. And that's, you know, this is one of the things we don't think about when we think about these great cameras. You're right, for athletics, the ability to slow this down and to annotate over that is huge.
Yeah, I feel like schools are going to want major increases in upstream bandwidth now after solving the downstream problem. I think there's going to be an upstream requirement soon as well. And there's a great app, I don't know if you used it, called Coach's Eye on iOS. It's really, really cool. And even before this high-quality camera, it was doing that kind of slow-mo analysis stuff. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have. One of the schools that we feed into that won the state baseball championship, they use that pretty heavily. It's a former he's an old friend of mine that's now the baseball coach there, and he absolutely loves it. And I think it's just the ability just to again stop that, and you can circle things. It's stuff that there was no easy way to do that before. Even if you had the video, there was no easy way to what are you going to get that into the computer and use Windows Movie Maker. There was just no way to do that easily before.
Yeah, no, this is the kind of thing that we talk about a lot with iPad. Is that it's not the case that you couldn't have done this before. But practically speaking, no, you couldn't have, because either you didn't have the time, you didn't have the skills, or you didn't have the money to achieve that kind of thing. And what we have inside our phone now is equivalent to what a sports TV studio was 15 years ago. If probably not better, actually better quality. And it's interesting when you look back at old sporting clips, how poor quality they were, even in your recent memory as well. So I think it's something to really keep an eye on. And I think for me, this is one of the applications that makes a case for the iPad getting a much better camera, is these kind of use cases, because they're more than just taking a photograph with your tablet, that kind of thing that everybody laughs at. But these are real analytical tools and data capture tools that can be really powerfully used in education.
I guess this is where the iPad Pro might come in, with it's conceivably would cost more, would have more room in the budget, or I guess in the margins, mm-hmm. to get that better camera there. Because it's not an issue of space, because they've got the space in there. It's just an issue of cost.
Yeah, yeah, particularly for the cheaper iPads. But if you could charge a bit more,
They've got the margins. We've been tweeting about this today, but I've got a coworker here that bought an 8 GB 5C. Usable for space is 5.4 GB. It's basically, it was full from the get-go.
Yeah.
I think the iOS 8 update wanted close to 5 gigs just to do the point upgrade, and she had to do it through iTunes. And the fact that I'm having to tell people to use iTunes to update their phone in 2014 is kind of pathetic.
Yeah, it's kind of like we're rolling backwards a little bit. We're almost having to retether our devices because of, not just because of space requirements, but because of data size requirements as well. I mean, I've been plugging in iPads recently to, suck off a whole bunch of camera roll stuff that I needed to move quickly. I didn't have time to wait for all to upload, to Google Drive over the, that link. So that kind of thing, it's not just the storage space on the device, although we've agreed many times that that is an issue, but it's also the amount of data that is there that you need to move somewhere else as well.
The original iPhone was 8 GB, had 6.9 of free space in 2007. Mm-hmm. And I know the OS was much smaller then.
Yeah.
But then you've got a phone that's sold today, an 8 GB 5C, that has 5.4 GB free space. That is a terrible customer experience. Had another teacher with a 16 GB iPhone 5 come to me. She's like, I know how to update the iOS 8. It's telling me I need to clear off. So I don't know what else to clear off. Yep. She has 3 GB free. That is enough. I mean, what am I? I don't even know what to tell her, because it's like she had 1 gig of photos, 1 gig of messages, I think 1 gig of music, and the rest were apps. Mm-hmm. And so it's I'm going to tell her, okay, you have to delete all your music, you need to delete all your text messages, and you need to upload everything off your camera roll, and then you can update to an OS.
And then 3 days later, you can update to iOS 8. Yeah.
And then you have to resync your music, you have to re-import your photos to your camera roll, and you never get the text messages back. I mean, it's this is a terrible customer experience. And I'm going to think I've got to be wrong here, but you wonder if people at Apple are all using I'm assuming the people that make these kind of decisions are not paying for iPhones. They probably are just given iPhones.
Yeah.
If not at a very reduced price. But you wonder if they're just not getting the 16 GB. You want to give everybody an Apple? I'm going to give you the lowest end phone you sell. I want you to use that for a month. And you tell me what the customer experience is like. It's not good.
Yeah, dog food that for a while. See how it goes.
And I know that's people's choice to buy what phone they want to buy. I get that. But people don't, I've had multiple people this week tell me, well, I bought more space on iCloud. I still can't update my phone.
Yep.
These are what goes through regular people's minds.
Nobody understands the difference between iCloud storage and storage on your phone. Simple as that. And it's partly a function of they're a victim of the fact that iCloud is so kind of transparently working in many areas. That people don't understand that iCloud isn't on your phone, because they have actually blurred the boundary between the two quite substantially in many areas, particularly in iOS 8 with things like the Photos app. that there still is a hard distinction between local storage and non-local storage, and the fact that they're all called storage is about as much as most people can actually deal with properly.
If 8 gigabyte, 16 gigabyte are going to exist, what Apple needs to do when these situations where there's not enough space, just figure out some system where you can remove data and then re-download it off after the OS has been installed. You know, you've got the, you know, as long as there's an iCloud backup, you can restore every bit of that data with the app. Like if you had to delete all of the apps, you delete all the apps, re-download them and restore the data that's inside those apps, or you know, do something like that with the music. Do something, or anyone who's buying a phone today can do an over-the-air update. You know, with you should not have to ask for more than like 800 megabytes to do one of these Delta updates.
You're essentially talking about doing a transparent backup and restore to iCloud.
Yes,
automatically after the update, right?
Yeah. Yes, and that's very conceivable, and just automate it in the background, or just make the low-end phone. I mean, the iPhone 5C should have been minimum 16 gig, minimum. Yeah. And because you're starting to wonder, how much longer can Apple even get 8 gigabyte memory chips? I mean, who even makes these anymore? It makes me sad.
Yeah, it's frustrating, and particularly when people, you know, it's not the sophisticated computer user that's making that choice. It's somebody who doesn't know better. And there's an article, I think it's probably on Medium because of the kind of mansplaining style of this article, but it was talking about how like beginner computer users need the best computers, and it's actually the high-end nerds who can actually cope with a much less powerful computer, because they know how to work around this and they understand the difference between storage and cloud storage and all of these different things. So that basically the beginner user needs an incredibly powerful computer with a huge amount of storage so that they never have to try and figure out the problem of these things, whereas it's people like you and I who can work around that. So that's an interesting argument as well, that the beginner user should actually get the biggest phone, because then they don't have to deal with these hard problems. And they are hard problems, there's no doubt about it.
Yes. But that's the end of my rant. I could go on about that all day.
I'm going to pull a plug on you.
You had a great find yesterday, a keyboard that was built for schools.
Yeah. So this is a keyboard called Kidogo. I think it's Kweedogo. And it's basically something I've mentioned a number of times that schools could use. And it's a lowercase keyboard for iOS 8. And it comes in two different flavors, if you like. One, there's a standard one and the Pro one. And the Pro one has like onboard word prediction, so it doesn't send anything to any cloud. It's just onboard on the device. But we have deployed the standard one for our 5-year-olds, and I've only just done it. I just did it yesterday, so I'm not sure how it's gone yet. But teachers seem quite keen on it. And what it does is it makes the keyboard more colorful. It also does things like it highlights in different colors the vowel keycaps. So E, I, O, and U are in red, whereas all the other keycaps are in black. And then the special keys like shift and return and backspace have got all different colors as well, so that the teachers can refer to hit the red key to take away your letters or whatever. And the reason for this is that in at least in our system of teaching the alphabet, we don't usually teach the 5-year-olds the uppercase alphabet. We teach them the lowercase alphabet first, and then sometimes it's a year or a bit more before they learn the uppercase variants of the letters they've learned at 5 years old. So that has been heretofore a bit of a barrier to iPad use at that level, because they didn't know what the letters were because they hadn't seen those letter forms, those uppercase letter forms. So I think it's going to work quite well for primary one. And I'll report back on how it goes.
Yeah, the only issue I could see here on the deployment is you're still going to have to touch every iPad to enable the keyboard.
Yeah, I think that's going to be something that the teacher might just do as a sort of preparatory step in the class at some point. But to be fair, you only have to do it once. You know,
that's true.
It's not something you have to do every day. But
Before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor of the night. It is iDevBooks. It's a new sponsor this week. iDevBooks is a Finnish app company that they've been making iOS apps for math for 5 years. They have 26 math apps in the store, from column addition to polynomial long division. And I'm going to – is this Edudemic? Is that what that's – okay. When Edudemic selected iDevBooks math apps among the 20 best education apps – And Web Tools of the Year, they stated the apps are focused on making concepts easy to learn rather than bogged down with bells, whistles, and ads. To me, that's, for an educational app, that's like one as a an extreme compliment.
That's high praise.
Right, yep. Right there, yeah. So they have a special deal for the podcast listeners. You can get any of their apps, any one of their apps for free by using their feedback form at devbooks.com. Just contact them, say you heard about the offer on the Out of School podcast, and let them know which app you want. Your email address will only be used to send you the code for the app, and this code is valid to the end of the calendar year into 2014, but you definitely want to hurry because they only have a limited number of free apps to give away. So again, go to idevbooks.com and go to the feedback form. Let them know which app that you want for free and that you heard about the offer on Out of School. So thanks to idevbooks for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay. So, something that is a little bit more up-to-date, Bradley, Apple sent out an invitation.
Yes.
Did you get
yes.
one?
No.
Did you? No. but there's going to be an event. We're recording on the 9th of September, and there's going to be an event next Thursday. Presumably, one guesses, to do with new iPads.
Yes, and in preparation, I have sold my iPad, so I am living without an iPad right now, which is an interesting experiment, actually.
Mm-hmm. But
it's weird. I mean, it's in some ways, it's like I'm okay. I'm just, you know, I have an iPhone 6 and mm-hmm. a MacBook Air. I'm just kind of making it work, so it's kind of a neat experiment. And I'm thinking I'm going to get a Retina Mini, I think, even mm-hmm. after as much as we've kind of dogged it a little bit. I'm wondering if, because I've realized, like, you know, when we talked about sizes, like just how people like different size laptops, people have different preferences on size of iPads and iPhones. Yeah. You know, a lot of it comes down to preference. And so I was really unhappy with my last Mini, but I'm interested to see, was that because it was slow and non-Retina?
Mm-hmm. I bet it was partly because it was slow. Because those original A5-based Mini iPads are pretty slow now.
Yes, absolutely. My wife still has one. I'm thinking I'm going to sell hers and upgrade it as well. Mm-hmm. And so I sold my iPad Air. Yesterday, I had a guy off Craigslist come to my office, and he paid me in cash. So I'm thinking I'm going to end up with probably the mid-tier Mini, assuming it's probably 16, 64, and 128. Of course, I think they've got four tiers of Minis right now, so they may continue with the 32 gig. I'll get a minimum of a 32 gig. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, I think one of the things I'm most looking forward to is Touch ID, because I've really started to enjoy Touch ID on my iPhone, and not necessarily for security on getting into the device, but for authenticating into things like 1Password, it'll be very helpful.
Yes, I think with the release of iOS 8, having Touch ID is starting to become much more of a thing than just how to open your device.
Yes, it's much, yeah, it's that's just like step one. This is like, lets you get into Evernote, lets you get into 1Password. You know, ScanBot has it now. It's as much about that. It's kind of like multiple layers of security. Mm-hmm. And the more I've used Touch ID, the more I think this would be a great addition to the Mac.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Definitely. And they could even add that. Like, you know, like I use a laptop day to day, but I've got an external trackpad. That could easily be bundled into the next trackpad and mouse. You could, you know, have a little section on the mouse that, you know, is your thumbprint sensor. And then anybody... Yeah. that has an existing Mac could use it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how, to what extent can that stuff move across. I don't know that you would see it in a trackpad, because remember how they store the thumbprint information is in a secure enclave on the ACU's processor. So I don't know if you could put it in a trackpad without having a possible security compromise that you'd have to transfer some thumbprint information over the air before it got to the secure enclave to be compared. It would be interesting to see if that was something that they're willing to take a chance on. But yeah, I think it's hard for me at the moment to think, you know, what could they do to the iPad? You know, obviously, I'll always take a faster iPad. I'll always take one with more storage. Although my 128 gig iPad Air has been doing fine for me for a long time. Obviously, the big rumor, Bradley, is that it's going to get bigger. There's going to be a so-called iPad Pro, a 12.9 or so inch iPad, and whatever that implies, we're not really clear yet, but I think there's an interesting kind of feeling abroad that the iPad has to do a little bit more, or quite a lot more possibly, in order to sort of justify its existence. And I think now we're just starting to get the operating system that the iPad needed all along, which is iOS 8, in terms of the extensions and the inter-app working and things like that. I'm certainly finding that I'm able to do a lot more without any barriers in the way with iOS 8 than I have in previous versions. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes along. I feel very strongly that the iPad can't stay where it is. I mean, if Apple just comes out and says, oh, here's your new iPad, it's still the same size as the old iPad, just a wee bit thinner and a bit faster, I'm going to be wondering, well, what's going on with that? I think there's got to be some movement in iPad to make it more of Apple's entry-level laptop, if you like, even though it's not a laptop. But you know what I mean? Like the first Apple computer that people get is an iPad. How is that going to be possible?
You know, you wonder, you know, are the limitations of the iPad at this point, is it the apps that are available? Is it the, you know, we're just now catching up to the OS? And I guess the key now is that app developers should go into this thinking, I'm going to make something that is as functional as my desktop version. This will be one-to-one as functional, if not better.
Yeah, I feel that there's two limitations on iPad. And number one is that third-party developers aren't using their iPads in the way that people like you and I are using their iPads. I think if Apple could put Xcode on the iPad, I think suddenly developers would find more reasons to pick up their iPad and start to use it. Because every developer uses their phone, right? So they know what they want from their phone. Whereas I think a lot of developers have an iPad because they want to write iPad apps rather than because they want to be an iPad user. And I think if the iPad were able to do a bit more, then particularly in the area of kind of coding and things like that, I think that more developers would use it, and as they used it, they would want more from it themselves, and they would start to build more for it. The second thing I think is probably the main limitation of the iPad and iOS at the moment is Safari. Now, I've praised mobile Safari many, many times, but I think it's the one thing, the web is the one thing that keeps driving me back to the desktop. I don't know if you find that, but I mean, many, many tasks that I have to do involve either uploading to the web or downloading from the web or filling in some fiddly form on the web. And I know it's not Apple's fault that most web designers aren't good at designing for touch, but I feel like if I have a big, big web task to do, I'm going to go back and do it on my Mac because that's a sort of more... it feels to me more stable and more trusted for some reason, even though it's not necessarily more stable like programmatically than my iPad. But I just feel like something could go wrong halfway along on the iPad. I mean, everybody's had this experience where they've tried to, you know, say buy something on an e-commerce website, and it's that complex multi-step process that isn't Amazon or Apple, where you have to, you know, sign into your account and then put in your credit card information, put in your address and look it up in a funny JavaScript window and all of these things. And that never goes right on the iPad, even today. And I don't know how Apple can fix that, or even if they can fix it at all, but I think to me that's one of the areas where I feel that the iPad doesn't completely have my back, or even the iPhone for that matter, is in these non-optimized websites that have complex multi-step forms involved. It just never seems to go well enough for me. And then there's the whole issue of uploading and downloading files as well.
You know, one of the things that the Chrome browser added this week was the ability to download files to Google Drive from the app. I've not figured out how it works because it's in the release notes, but I've yet to figure out how it works. Okay. But no, I totally agree. I had a teacher email me two PDFs and said, hey, can you upload these to our website? And I thought, no, I'm just going to do that for my Mac. I'll send these to Dropbox. When I get back to my Mac, I'll just upload them there because it's faster and it's easier. And to me, it feels like that's a task that's perfect for iOS. I mean, even the phone, I should be able to to do that. And it's not even like that WordPress's back end doesn't work well with an iPad or an iPhone, because it actually works okay. But just the uploading the files. I mean, I shouldn't have to use the iCab browser and open it into that and upload it. I mean, there should just be a way, just as how you can upload photos to a website, you should be able to upload things from iCloud.
Well, you know, it's missing parts, right? You know, why isn't it possible to just go and pick out your iCloud drive? I mean, that should be a thing now, right? Because that's what iCloud Drive is all about, is using files from one app in another app. So how come Safari is not participating in that for file uploads? That's my question.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there are websites that are just terrible on iOS, and yeah. I don't know why. I don't know if it's like, you know, Google Drive on Safari on the Mac. It just is terrible, and I don't know whose fault it is, but it's terrible, and I don't really care why it's terrible, but I just wish it was better.
Yeah, yeah.
Like we're having a weird issue on Yosemite, our time clock application. Not even Yosemite, but it's just the most recent version of Safari. Mm-hmm. We have a little local time clock application that's running on a little web server here, and it does not work on the most recent version of Safari. Like, it's not that it doesn't work, but it like rejects your passcode every time. And you do the same passcode on Firefox or Chrome, works fine. But on the iPad, it works great because we actually use iPads to clock in majority of the time. But like, we have some people that do it on Safari on their Mac. It just doesn't work. It just says bad passcode. And I don't even know where to begin debugging that. I mean, it's got to be a Safari issue, but what do I tell Apple? Like, we have this little time clock application called Time Clock Plus that doesn't work on Safari anymore.
Yeah, sure that'll be – they'll get right on that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, these split screen apps, mm-hmm. you know, that we remember, you know, like I'm on the one hand thinking that's fantastic. On the other hand, I'm thinking this will be terrible, but it's experiments like these, I think I'm going to have to see that are going to take the iPad to the next level, because I don't think, you know, we've talked about this offline that if mm-hmm. majority of iPad apps at this point, except for a few, they're like blown up iPhone apps. And when you look at things that Apple's doing, like auto layout, where it makes it easier for developers to build, you know, apps that kind of, I guess what we call responsive apps.
Yeah.
That to me is not a good thing for the iPad.
Well, I mean, there are limits to responsive design, right? And I think if you look at any website that's responsive, none of them are responsive to being shown at full screen on a 27 inch iMac. You know, they're responsive up to a 15-inch laptop, and then who cares after that? They just stretch it beyond. But I think, I mean, there's an issue also that building custom UI for iPad is expensive, and at the moment, iPad isn't selling well enough to justify people developing those interfaces for the iPad. And I think that's something that in some ways, a bit of a chicken and egg problem. It's the chicken and egg problem that Windows Phone is in as well, is that not enough sales means not enough buyers means not enough apps. But at the same time, Benedict Evans pointed out this week that on Twitter that there are now more iPads in use than Macs. The installed base of iPad alone is actually bigger than the installed base of Macs. So the question is, does the iPad actually go upmarket? What if the iPad just became like a professional tool for people, and Apple made it so that, you know, the people who bought iPads were either, you know, kids playing games, okay, that's the iPad mini world, but the iPad Pro was a tool that vied with a 13-inch MacBook Air for people's money, and people would be willing to spend more on apps for a device like that, because that's, they've actually gone all the way into deciding that this is my main computer that I'm going to invest in, and so on. And I think, as much as I kind of hesitate to say it, that in some ways Microsoft might be right with the Surface, that actually that's where iPad needs to go in order to become that truly powerful, very serious work tool for a large proportion, or at least a proportion, maybe not a large proportion, but let's say 25% of Apple's laptop buyers become iPad Pro buyers instead. Would that be a good thing for Apple? It would certainly be a good thing for iPad, I think. And I think it would also be a very good thing for iPad developers, that people like Omni Group and so on would start to see people buying their... I mean, obviously people are buying, but they would start to see more people buying their $25 and $13 iOS apps, which some of which I use and love very much. But I think there's probably not enough people buying enough of those apps to keep enough developers in business. Omni are obviously doing very well, and they deserve all of that success. But I think other people need to see that kind of success as well at higher price points.
And imagine a way if you could have two 13-inch iPads on your desk somehow linked together over a lightning cable. I mean, they could somehow, you could, I don't know, this is way out there, I'm thinking off the cuff, maybe you even have like an iPad mini-sized device down below it that's kind of like your trackpad and your keyboard. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of these rethinking of computing mm-hmm. technologies and or some sort of like Surface type keyboard. But the bottom line is, the iPad to me seems like it's getting into it's a bigger phone market, and mm-hmm. you know, and that's not what it can be. And I think it's also it's like the desktop and laptop kind of situation where for the most people now, like a laptop is completely enough.
Yeah.
And the desktops still sell, not as well, but they still sell, and there are definitely reasons to buy them. You know, when you've got a thing like the 6 Plus, are people like, you know, this is enough? I know our friend Gabe Weatherhead, at Mac Drifter on Twitter, says since he bought his 6 Plus, he's not picked up his iPad Mini one time. Now, if he had an iPad Air, would that be different? And that's mm-hmm. the thing I'm interested in is like, what's the device makeup here? Do people that have the 6 and an Air, do they use, what's their usage time? Like, or what's their preferred device versus someone that say has a Mini and a Plus versus someone that has a Plus and an Air, or maybe then we can think about a Plus and a Pro. That's the research I'd love to see. Mm-hmm. And I think you could sort of kind of gather some correlation there and see, you know, why do people use a certain device? Or do they pick up their iPad just because it's bigger and it's more comfortable? Yeah. That's not a reason for that device to exist.
That is not enough of a reason. You know, it's too expensive in many cases to justify just being a slightly bigger version of the phone. And I think, you know, being a slightly bigger phone is where Android tablets have gone to die for years now. You know, that's always been the knock against Android tablets, and it's not wrong that too many of the applications on that platform are just they're just Android phone apps made large. And up to this point, iPad has done very well because it is not that there are actually unique and special and valuable interfaces designed just for iPad. And in some ways, those iPad-specific apps are the things that have justified the iPad for me. You know, your Explain Everything, the new OmniFocus, OmniGraffle. I'm recording this show in Aria on my iPad, which is a full desktop audio workstation. It's super powerful. And if those apps can't make it, then that's a problem. But I think that if the iPad were to go upwards again, I feel like there's upward pressure and everything. I could see a lot of overlap for most people between an iPhone 6 Plus and an iPad Mini. But since I got my 6 Plus, I've used my iPad plenty, but I feel like I'm using it more like a laptop now. I'm doing things like recording this show, which I used to do on my laptop. I'm now doing that on my iPad because the iPad's kind of moving up, and I'm now looking for ways, and iOS 8 is actually providing many of those ways for me to get more from my iPad as well. So even as my phone becomes more capable, it's sort of forcing me to rethink what I'm doing higher up the computing stack, if you like. And increasingly what I'm feeling is that I'm using my iPad more, I'm using my phone more, and I'm actually using my Mac even a bit less than before, except for those things that we mentioned before, like the web tasks. You know, essentially it's a very, very, very fast Chromebook at the moment, you know.
One of the main things I use my laptop for at home is MailChimp work for some of the freelance jobs I do. I mean, and it's things like that the iPad has just, that needs to be done on the iPad. And I don't know if that's MailChimp's fault or if that's Apple's fault for bad tech selection. But that's an iPad workflow. Like, that would be so much easier on an iPad. Yeah. Or it should be, I guess. It's not, but it should be.
Yeah, it feels to me like the WebKit rendering and the text selection and things like that are some of the most frustrating parts. The navigation between fields and the behavior, and there's too often people are just too clever with JavaScript, you know, and that's what ruins it, I think, in large part. You're typing into a tiny little form with a big keyboard up on the screen, and then suddenly everything just jumps away. Like, where did all it go? And you've got to zoom the screen out and close the keyboard to find where you were again. And then every time you type a letter, the form jumps away again. You know, it's just too much of that stuff going on.
Yes, and this is where you'd insert a GIF or a GIF, depending on how you would say it, or of me like banging something with a bat.
Yeah, that's maddening. I mean, there's also talk though of this hypothetical iPad Pro also running macOS 10, which I don't know what you think about that rumor, Bradley, but I think that is extremely unlikely. I'll tell you why.
Yes, yeah, I agree. Tell me why, though.
RAM. Simple as that. Every iPad right now has got a gigabyte of RAM. most Macs come with at least 8. And 8 is just about okay. In fact, 8's fine, right? 4 is only barely okay, and 4 is only the default RAM on the lowest entry-level Macs at the moment. So if you're telling me that this device is going to run iOS 8 and Yosemite, it's going to have to get 8 times the RAM in one generation? I'm unconvinced by that. And the reason I'm unconvinced is because of the cost of that part, but more likely the battery consumption of 8 times the memory, 8 times the battery consumption for that RAM.
What do you think? Well, and then you, I mean, that would, you would have to assume at that point that you would have OS X running on ARM.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and so it's like you'd need some sort of you'd have to have some sort of like translation software like Rosetta. But as you mentioned to me, there were so many performance gains that are going to Intel from PowerPC, Rosetta can make that, you know, can make up those differences.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you're going to, I mean, you're going to go from like, you know, what's my Mac like? Some sort of, it's an i5. Mm-hmm. You go from an i7 to an A8, A9, A10.
Yep.
I mean, I'm not saying we can't get there. I just don't think we're there yet.
And I think the problem you've got with that, it's a bit like, you know, having Coke and New Coke out at the same time, is that if you've got a MacBook Air running an i7 there and you've got an iPad Pro running an ARM chip here and you're running the same, you've installed the same software in both, it's just going to be obvious, you know, how much worse that's going to perform on the weaker machine. So, and I mean, this is not even to start to begin to talk about the whole problem with the fact that OS X is just not designed to be touched. I mean, you fire up any VNC client on your iPad and try and work a Mac, you can do it, but it's nothing like the way it needs to be. It just isn't.
No, I agree. It's workable, but like not day to day. You're getting your job done on it.
Yeah. Yep. It's actually even more awkward than trying to use those stupid websites in Safari and the iPad.
Before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor of the night. It's fine folks at Jamp Software. I know we had some listeners this week that have signed up with Jamp, so we definitely appreciate their support.
Yeah.
Jamp provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in education, Macs, iPhones, iPads, and even Apple TVs they support. They have a great app called Casper Focus that allows teachers to install an app on their iPad and take control of their classroom experience. They can conduct secure exams within an app, quickly gain students' attention, select a specific Apple TV, they can choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus and Jamp software. Go to addaschool.net, and the show notes for this episode, it's episode 106. They have a special link, and that lets the folks at the Jamp know that you came to them from our show. So thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show this week.
Can I give you some Jamf hotness with iOS 8? Yeah.
Yes.
Just discovered this today. I was doing some work on a student's device under the latest version of Casper Suite. And if your client support is running iOS 8, iOS 8 will now report to an MDM whether or not iCloud backup is enabled. And secondly, when the date of the last iCloud backup was. How cool is that?
Yeah, that's very nice. And so you could then create a report that would basically, you know, let you know, okay, these kids haven't updated, you know, I mean, I'm assuming this will work, but like these iPads haven't updated to iCloud or backed up to iCloud in 3 days, in 5 days.
And so yeah, you can build a smart group for that.
That's the word I was thinking of, smart group. Yeah, you can build a smart group for that, and that would be fantastic.
So it allows you to say if the day of the last iCloud backup is not in the last X days and give a number. So if you say, you know, a 5 day window or something like that, you'll get an email whenever a device goes into that group, whereas it goes into the not in the last 5 days group. So you will be notified when people's backups are starting to get out of date, which is really cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So last topic of the show we're going to talk about is contacts and calendars, and kind of just a broad overview of that, what we're doing, where the options are, and just kind of, you know, delve into it. You know, we've mentioned both that you and I are both Google App schools. There are plenty of other options. First is Exchange. And I guess most schools, I would think nowadays, are running Exchange 365. We're getting to the point where it's just not realistic to, I don't think it's wise, unless you're a giant, giant district where you have people that this is their only job, to manage your Exchange server. You should be using Exchange 365.
Yep. You got to host that stuff. Unless you can really have staff a department in order to babysit that stuff for you.
Well, and then it's, you know, if you got a certain number of staff members, and it's more cost effective to hire people to deal with it than it is to outsource it. But I would think for the average school, it's just easier to outsource it to Exchange 365. And then you can get, and of course, you can integrate in with Active Directory. And then you get all, you can all get the, all the online office suite, and you kind of get the Google Apps experience with a Microsoft ecosystem.
Yeah. Yep. And I suppose there's iCloud as well, but not really. It's not really meant for that, is it?
We need Apple to do a Google Apps version of iCloud. I mean, where you could integrate in with iTunes U. Mm-hmm. I work for iCloud. That's just, they need to do that. That's one of those kind of low hanging fruit in education. I know it's a big thing to do. It's a big thing to tackle, but it kind of just needs to happen. I mean, I know running mail servers, like they look at, I think, email differently than Gmail does, or that Google does with Gmail. But that's just one of those things they need to get better at, because they're letting Google exist in schools when they shouldn't have to.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, at my school, which is one of the most Apple schools in the area, we're still, you know, dependent on Google for our back end. You know, we've been on Google since nearly 10 years now, and we are slowly drifting more towards that because we're not getting the same kind of features and functionality from Apple in some areas, particularly the kind of document collaboration, the Google Drive stuff that we've talked about many times, but also just the email and the accounts and things like that, the groups, you know, all of that stuff, the dashboard. I mean, imagine you could have an iCloud dashboard the way you have a Google Apps dashboard. Wouldn't that be a great thing for making and, you know, connecting Apple IDs and things like that, rather than be having to use Keyboard Maestro and iTunes to try and make that work? Which is crazy.
Well, even just like, you know, when I need to share a document with people here, I know what their email address is. I know what their Google Apps account is. Well, if it's like iCloud, it's like, oh, hey, you know, we have a guest coming on in a few weeks, and I sent him a direct message. I was like, hey, what address can I share a Google document with? Oddly enough, he gave me an iCloud. And that's how you would be with, if you're trying to use, you know, iWork for iCloud inside your school, you'd say, hey, what Apple ID are you using? Like, is it the school address? Is it your home address? Like, which one can I share that with? And that's just not functional.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. And you're right. The point you make is great, that because we're on this back end made by Google, it actually would make it super easy for us to switch to Chromebooks. It really would. You know, I'm not saying we're going to do that, and I'm not saying I want to do that. But having, you know, Google Apps is like the gateway drug to Chromebooks for many schools. And I think what you're seeing in a lot of schools that are going Chromebook is, the door has been opened for them by the fact that school is on Google Apps and has been established on Google Apps for a long time. And I think that in some ways that's a major risk for Apple, is that it just becomes easier to move everything into the Google world than to try and keep pushing through the Apple world.
Absolutely. Chris, we, you know, kind of moving on to the calendar apps. Mm-hmm. I hate iCal on the Mac, I guess, in terms of like an actual deploying it to users. Because I just get way too many errors. Like, I had a GoToMeeting invite today that I was trying to add to my iCloud calendar. It just didn't do it. Like, it kept asking me to revert to the server, give me some sort of error. That's not something I want to deal with. It's so much easier in Google Calendar for users just to, like, be in the Gmail web interface, click add to Google Calendar. Like, Google has nailed that part of it. And there are just aspects of that. Even when you're using CalDAV and you're syncing with your Google Calendar, it's just not perfect.
Yeah, I've certainly toyed myself. The way I set up my personal calendar is that I have a number of iCloud calendars for myself, and that I share with my wife, and she shares hers with me. And the big feature I like there is that we get notifications when either of us changes the other calendar. So if my wife puts something in her calendar, I get a notification about it. And if I do that, she gets a notification about mine. But for school, we just have an additional Google account called Diary that we share the password for with other teachers in the school. So basically everybody logs into the same account on all their devices, and there's one calendar that everybody sees. Which, I don't know how you do it, Bradley, but that to me was like the least effort. Not that it doesn't have downsides, like people can put their personal things in the school calendar by mistake and so on, but it was at least simple to set up.
I created a calendar under our admin account. It's like the BBS, you know, school calendar.
Yep.
We embed that on our school website. And then I also sent the, what do they call it? The, like the iCal, you know, basically the address for it.
Yeah.
To all of our teachers, said, here's how you add it to your phone, or you can just go to the website. Because personally, I don't actually want that on my phone, because we have like a day schedule. So it's a 6-day rotation. Mm-hmm. And so like kids go to like their fine arts classes on a rotating schedule. Well, we list the days on that calendar. I don't want that on my phone because A, I don't care. And B, my son isn't in the grade where that actually starts. That doesn't start until kindergarten. He's in K-3.
Yeah.
And so I'm actually happy that it's actually just on the website. I can go to it and view it in a nice, you know, Google, with a Google Calendar view, and that really works. And then we had sent in information to our parents about how to add it to their phones, because there are plenty of parents who want that on their phones, because mm-hmm. they send, if it's PE, they know their kid goes to PE on day 3, well, they need to send gym clothes on day 3. Yeah. And so that works. And then I've given read and write. I've given write access to a couple people here that make changes to that calendar. They're adding events and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it works very well. But I would always, you know, recommend when you're doing this, do this from like an admin account, not from even an administrator account. That's a personal, you know, it's like your actual work account, because you don't want, like, if you leave that your account gets deleted somehow and then the calendar's gone. Just using, you know, always have an admin at your domain account that you do this stuff from.
Yeah, we do the same thing, except, like I said, we allow everybody to have edit privileges on that calendar. For the most part, that's okay. The biggest problem I'm running into with at the moment is that different people have got different defaults for what the default alert is for their calendar app. So some people have got their calendar app set so that everything they make gets an alert 24 hours before or a day before or whatever, and then you end up getting alerts from other people's calendars. Because it's not, when you subscribe to a calendar, you can turn off alerts because you don't want them. But when you actually own a calendar and have the password for it, I don't think there's a way to disable alerts en masse. So you end up getting alerts that other people set as well.
Yeah, that would be annoying.
At the moment, I'm kind of chasing around going, could somebody find out who's putting all these iTunes U events? Because the new version of iTunes U can put the deadlines for stuff in your calendar. So somebody's got the school private calendar set to their default calendar, which means that their iTunes U is pushing items into the calendar for everybody at the moment. So that's the major downside to that, is you don't know who did what.
Next thing is kind of our email groups. And we don't do anything with parents in our email groups. So we have an all staff, all teachers, all fine arts teachers, and all teachers assistants. So we I missed one. And we have the office staff.
Yeah.
But of course, we've ended up putting the office staff in just about every, like, it's basically turned out that everybody is in all staff and all teachers. So I don't even know why there's even a difference, but there is.
Yeah.
And then we do parent emails through RenWeb, and that is okay. Mm-hmm. I really wish they had some features I have to send out a message at like 6 o'clock tonight. I would like to just be able to pre-schedule that. Like, there are just features like that that it's missing.
Yeah.
I know I can't do that through, like, you know, even through Google, but, you know, I think you're going to talk about MailChimp shortly. That's a great feature of MailChimp. You can have something and pre-schedule it and be done. The reason we use RenWeb is because it's built in, and I don't have to manage another database. Like, if a parent changes their email address, I don't have to change it in RenWeb and in something else. But I mean, there's definite advantages of that. We do get open rates. And so, well, we don't get a percentage. I can see if someone opened it. There's like a transparent image in every email. Yep. And so when that email gets opened, the image is kind of pinged. And so I can tell if a parent hasn't opened that. But the downside is the way RenWeb works is, like, I have my work and my personal account with listed. We generally get 2 emails per parent. They just usually give us 2. RenWeb has space for 2. Well, you generally only read the email once. And so your listing is viewed, is skewed, mm-hmm. because you send, if a family has 4 email addresses on file, they get 4 separate emails.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of skews it a little bit, but it works. It just doesn't have all the features that we, you know, would love.
Yeah. I mean, we used to put our parents' email addresses into Google Groups as well, but have since stopped doing that because we had an incident a few years ago where somebody sort of did a reply to all, and the reply went to all the other parents as well. Unfortunately, there wasn't any confidential information in there, but it was potentially embarrassing to them. So we quickly stopped doing that, and we're now using MailChimp exclusively for communicating with parents, which has been okay. This is our second year using MailChimp, and it's okay. It has a lot of kind of... It's another one of these situations where you're not really using the thing for its exact purpose. So what we had... The first year we used it, what we did was we made individual lists for individual parent groups, so primary one, parents two, three, four, five, and so on. And what these separate lists enabled you to do was enabled you to... There's a thing called email beamer for MailChimp, and what you do is you send an email to a sort of secret address for the list, and then they reply back to you with what the email is going to look like, and then you reply back and say send, and that sends it. So that meant that teachers could email those lists just by using their normal email client and using an address that was I put in their address book. Whereas with the way we do it this year, we have one list for all the parents, and then I've made list segments for individual classes. And that has other trade-offs. One of the big disadvantages of having separate lists is that if you wanted to send something to a certain large subset of the parents, you had to basically duplicate your campaign as many times as you needed to and send it to different lists. And that meant if you wanted to email like four different year groups, but not the whole school, you'd have to duplicate your campaign four times and send it four times, which was kind of tedious. I thought I could solve that problem by going to one list with segments in it, but it turns out you can't send a campaign to multiple segments of a list. You can only send it to one segment at a time. So actually, I haven't solved that problem at all, unfortunately.
Yeah, none of these solutions are perfect, but I think you really... when you're sitting down evaluating how you're going to do this, is look at the size of your school, look at how often you're doing this, and what kind of emails you're sending.
Yeah.
There's not going to be, like, it just really depends.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the good things about MailChimp, you get to see open rates. There's good accountability for us to see who sent what to parents, because when I log into the dashboard, I can see all the campaigns and I can see who authored them and what they contained and when they were sent and who got them and who opened them. So there's a good, you know, sequence of accountability in there. And to be honest with you, I'm not that sure it's a bad thing that it's a wee bit harder to send an email to all the parents. You know, that's something that perhaps is actually better done in a more kind of controlled way than just having any teacher able to fire out anything to all the parents in one go.
Well, I firmly believe that our teachers don't have that ability. It's really just me, the headmaster, and our director of development. This email I'm sending out here in a little bit is something about our fall festival for the teacher who's kind of heading that up this year. Mm-hmm. But I just don't trust everybody with that kind of ability, because it could be, as you mentioned, that could be damaging. You know, if you accidentally sent something to the entire faculty that was meant for one parent. And that's easy to do in most interfaces. Like, if you're just not paying attention, you could easily do that. And that could be very damaging to the school. So I'm okay with it being a little bit inefficient to protect the school. And it's really just causing me more work. And this, you know, like the teacher said, hey, I want to send this out. Can I send this tonight? I said, you have to get it proofed by, we have a kind of a resident proofer, you have to get Miss Michelle to proof it, and then she'll send it to me and let me know when you want it to go out. And so I know everything's been proofed before we send it out, because it doesn't come from the teacher, it comes from the lady that proofs it.
Yeah, I think, I've never tried this, but I think in MailChimp you can give people account levels where they can create a campaign, but they can't send it. So they could write it, but then they'd have to come to you to actually send it. And I may be making that up, but it seems like the kind of thing that would be a good feature, and MailChimp possibly has something like that. The other thing I was going to say about that was that it's a wee bit harder as well to use the MailChimp interface, because it kind of puts a wee bit more requirement on your design. We have a template now that we use, but it took us a while to work that out. And that our emails look a whole lot better when they go out, but sometimes I see people who have made... some of the people who can make them, they've not been quite careful enough with like the font choice and stuff. They've pasted from Word or Pages or something, and it hasn't quite come through right, and they haven't really noticed enough, and they've sent out something that's a wee bit ugly as well. So there's a little bit of a additional requirement there in design as well.
Like, you've seen it where, like, if you forward text to somebody and then you paste it and you paste it into MailChimp, it's purple because it was purple in the email client.
Mm.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I've seen that. And I've seen newsletters go out where, like, it's got block quotes on it from the forward where somebody was approving it.
Mm. Yeah, these are the things.
Yeah, and it's Comic Sans.
Well, that is the font of education, am I right?
Yeah, sadly. Yeah. Sadly, you are. So, but yeah, you know, calendars in these distribution groups, I think you really got to sit and take the temperature of your school.
Mm-hmm.
And don't always do what's easiest. Do what gets the job done, but also where somebody can't delete. Even if you're a school of 100 teachers, you probably shouldn't give everybody admin access to the calendar. You know, again, should every one of your teachers have the ability to send something to the entire school? Maybe, but maybe not. I guess when teachers say, hey, can I send this out? And I say, no, only I can do it. You know, they kind of give you this look like, do you not trust me? And it's not that I don't trust people. It's just the accidents happen.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they don't understand the severity of sending an email to 300 students' parents, but I know every time I send out an email, I read it about 10 times, especially if it has something to do with t-shirts. Because if you misspell t-shirts, it's not a good situation. Or ducks, also not a good situation. Yes. Yeah. And so, like, I usually, before I send out those emails, I'll have somebody come in and read it. Like, did I spell this right? Does my subject look right? I have a subject, right? Because those are things that you can leave out that... It's like these are what people's image of your school are. You know, sometimes parents, you know, we have a lot of parents who are very involved, but some, they drop their kids off, they pick them up, and they read the emails. And that's fine. But, like, if our emails look subpar and they look kind of shoddy, well, then they may think that we're kind of a shoddy school and that we don't really have our act together. But they're professional looking, they're spelled correctly, they are professionally written. That makes us look like we know what we're doing.
Yeah. Have you started A/B testing your subject lines with your parents yet?
Not yet. That would be good though. Of course, you can do that in MailChimp. That would be interesting to see. Like, if you got, like, you know, if you worded something this way, did people show up for this event or not show up for this event?
Primary 6 went to the zoo. You'll never believe what happened next.
Oh me! All right, that's a great place to end it for the week. Okay. So we thanks so much to our sponsors that keep the lights on here. The fine folks at Jamp, Aerohive, and then we get the new sponsor this week, iDev Books. They have a great promo, so check them out. You can get a free app. No harm, no foul if you didn't like it. Just go give it a shot. But all the links to the sponsors will be at outofschool.net. We'll have links to anything we mentioned in the show notes at outofschool.net. You can find me on the web at Chambers Daily. I have a brand new design, a brand new logo. So if you've never been to my site, please go check it out. And I'm on Twitter at Chambers Daily. Are you on Elo or... Is that how it's pronounced, Elo, the new social network?
I am not, no.
I'm done with Twitter-like social networks.
Yeah, we rebuilt the whole of Twitter and we just did one different feature. In some ways, it's like those apps that used to recreate iCal, you know, and then they would put like weather icons on your events. You know, it's like, you know, so much is the same and one thing is different. You know, it's not enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Not even going to try to get my username. I'm not popular enough for someone to try to squat on it. I just, you know, I app.net kind of just burn me on Twitter like services that aren't Twitter. And on Accidental Tech Podcast this week, they have a good discussion about that as well.
Yeah. All right. So I am on Twitter at Fraser Spears. And spears.org on the web, and we'll talk next week.